Well, good morning, good afternoon, or good evening, whenever you're listening. This is Davisville on KDRTLP 95.7 FM in Davis, California. You can find us online anytime you like at kdrt.org/Davisville. I'm Bill Buchanan. I'm your host. Thank you for tuning in. And it is time for our annual autumnal movie show with Davis film critic and author Derek Bang, in which we look at the fate of filmdom this year, plus get his takes on movies to see and avoid as movie makers bring out their best end-of-the-year films. Derek, thanks for joining us again.
Oh, Bill, thank you for having me. We've been doing this every year now for how long?
I think maybe 14 years.
Oh, my goodness.
Which, by the way, brings me to a point that you are marking a milestone this year.
Oh, golly, yes, it's true.
Yeah, so 50 years as a film critic.
Almost to the month.
So, well, we're just on top of things here on Davisville. Now, the fact of the matter is, if the Enterprise was still the paper it was, they'd be doing a big feature on this because you've been writing for them for a long, long time. You've had your blog, Derek Bang on Film. That's your main outlets right now, the Enterprise and your blog. But you've written for others. Anyway, you must know I'm not going to let that milestone go unremarked. But first, congratulations. And this actually is, I want to start off with a question. What inspired you, you know, when you were starting out to write about movies?
It's a very good question. We were a movie-going family. Both my parents took me to films from a pretty young age. My sisters didn't come along until I was 8 and 9, respectively. And I began reading film reviews in the Los Angeles Times, which was the paper we got every morning, at a reasonably young age. I remember doing it from junior high school. By the time I hit UC Davis, my freshman year, I was getting very annoyed by the fact that you could still buy the LA Times in print editions here in Davis at that point in time. Their critics never seemed to enjoy the movies they were watching. They were always very critical pieces. And I was fed up with the fact that they didn't seem to be having a good time. So when I was approached by a friend who had become one of the guys who would drastically turn the UC Davis California Aggie into a serious newspaper my sophomore year, 74-75, to come on board, I said, sure, I'd love to be a film critic. And with the benefit of hindsight, I realize that I took the Roger Ebert approach to film criticism rather than the more scholarly Gene Siskel approach. You watch the two of them, Roger always seemed to be the one who, even when he didn't like a film, you get the sense that he had a good time sitting there for 2 hours. Gene always seemed to be something of a grump. That's what made them such a great team. And over time, I realized that the way I wanted to write was conversational, as if I were having a conversation with the reader, the same way I would have a conversation with constant companion, my wife, on the way home from a movie, because I found that some of the best things that came out in some of my reviews would be some of the points that we raised together in the car driving home. Mm-hmm. And I thought, so, you know, I want readers to be able to read this stuff and think they're actually talking to me.
Yeah, so a lot of interesting points in that answer, but it struck me just that you saw movie going as fun, and that should be reflected in how people assess the movies.
I think so.
As opposed to an artifact.
I still do.
Yeah, yeah. Well, I think that comes through in your reviews. I mean, when you have something you like, you really say it. And it's not just like, this is a significant accomplishment for filmdom. It's more like, this is a really great movie. Or, you know, or you say, you know, it ends too quickly. Or, I mean, there's a variety of ways that you have expressed when you really like something.
I think it's important. I don't think film critics, unless they're writing for The New Yorker, should be writing as if they're university publications.
Oh, we'll hear from UC Davis on that one. But you're an alum, so they could just, you know.
Yeah, well, no, but the heck with it.
Yeah, but that is part of the freedom of a critic too, right, is to be able to express things. That's your personality. I think that's part of what's valuable, is that gives people a benchmark to judge against.
Well, I would like to think so, and I would like to think that at this late remove, at least a fair number of people think it's a reasonable benchmark.
Yeah. So how did you learn to write a good review? And, you know, good not in the sense of the movie's good. And there's not necessarily a favorable review, but, you know, one that's competent criticism.
Well, so here's a confession. I'm self-taught.
Yeah.
So it's not as if I went and took a film criticism class for a quarter and then decided to become a film critic at the California Aggie. I just kind of jumped in with both feet. And the quick answer to your question is practice, practice, practice. Assuming you have some facility for any activity, if you do it often enough and long enough, one hopes you will become better at it.
But you must have learned from other critics or things you've read.
True. As I already mentioned, I had been reading film criticism for a fair number of years at that point. So I knew the general template. But I got to say, my first couple of years, at least, I look back on them with pain. And in fact, I'm going to gift you with the opening sentence to the very first review I ever wrote, which was published in October 1974 in the California Aggie, about the film The Night of the Living Dead, which had screened a couple nights earlier. Uh-huh. Okay? So in the first place, this was a useless review because it ran after the fact. This was before home video even. It's not as if people could expect the movie to be playing again on campus.
Well, no. In fact, that movie had been played, was released several years prior, right?
And so 1968.
Yeah. So it would show up like on a campus screening or something. But yeah, it takes your point. It wasn't like you could just go get it.
So are you ready? Here we go.
I am.
In this technological age of fantastic machinery, bombs that can travel and destroy entire cities in mere seconds, and loudmouth politicians who feel there has to be a complicated and highly incomprehensible explanation for everything, it's somewhat strange that a film as basically simple as Night of the Living Dead should succeed at all, let alone become a phenomenal cult movie that never fails to attract a crowd of people just waiting to be scared. Now, in fairness, I think the second half of that is better than the first half.
Yeah, I was going to say.
But still.
Yeah, I mean, it's
true. I like to think I've gotten better.
Yeah, you've gotten much, much more on the mark. But honestly, when you said this was my first sentence, I was bracing myself for something really, you know, I don't know, pompous or just inept.
I think it is pompous, actually.
But you know, there's pompous and then there's pompous. Because you know? I think you're right. The second part makes a valid point. The first part is just, you know, you're clearing your throat.
Yes.
And you know, you're sort of bowing to the times, you know, and that's that sort of, I'll call it what I think it is, sophomoric profundity. In a times like ours.
Oh, yes.
You know, and really what people want is, hey, Derek, how's the movie?
But then
you told them. And you told them, and you told them a lot, actually, in that second part of there. So.
Well, even so.
Well, okay. So now this is the moment. Before we venture into this year's crop of dazzlers and duds and anything else, I have a surprise for you, Derek. I have something to play for you.
Uh-oh.
It's a message. It's a message from a movie director you have worked with in your capacity as an expert on the Peanuts comics. Okay, folks, here we go.
Hi, Derek. Steve Martino here. I just wanted to let you know that I was thinking of you on this major milestone in your career. Now, you may not be aware of this, but as the director of the Peanuts movie, I've never had a more terrifying and yet supportive relationship with a movie critic than I've had with you. It was a very Dr. Jekyll and Mr. Hyde kind of experience as we made and then finally released the movie. Now, this is because you are one of the most passionate and knowledgeable fans of Charles Schulz's work that I have ever met. And knowing that one day you would review our movie, well, that was the terrifying part. And to be honest, it was a daily motivation for me. Like you, I'm a big fan of Peanuts, and our team mantra was to honor the legacy of what Charles Schulz gave to us. Now, the wonderful aspect of this journey was the support that you provided on a regular basis as we made the movie, because of your incredible knowledge of all things Peanuts. Your website, 5 Cents Please, was our go-to source for so many details and answers to questions as we made the film. Now, showing you the movie was an incredibly nerve-wracking day for me, but your review of the film was probably one of the best days. Thank you for driving our filmmaking journey in ways that you may not have realized. And congratulations on 50 years of doing what you do so very well.
Oh, my God.
There you go, Derek. You terrified a film director. Here's a career accomplishment.
He is the nicest guy.
Well, yes. Now, this was a surprise. Derek had no idea we were going to be doing this here today. We just thought, I thought it would be fun. And so I asked, is there someone in the industry who maybe would be willing to record something? And so I pitched him, and he said, sure, I'd be glad to. And so he recorded that at his home.
That's outstanding. Well, I am, to use one of my favorite expressions, gobsmacked.
So what did you do for the Peanuts movie? This is the one, 2015, and I think he's working on another one.
Honestly, in terms of directly, almost nothing. I mean, he and I were in touch on occasion, and he did have a few specific questions. But as he explained in the statement that he just made, most of the research he did was stuff that my confederate Scott McGuire and I had already published in the 5 Cents Please blog. And also the book that I wrote in 2000, 50 Years of Happiness, a tribute to Charles M. Schulz, which at the time I had wanted to be some sort of a Peanuts Bible. So the direct answer to your question is that my input was mostly passive from that standpoint. But he made it very clear as we got closer and closer to the unveiling of the film, which was an afternoon I will never forget. It was at the George Lucas Theater at the Presidio in San Francisco. And he was nervous. he was nervous. But I remember assuring him when it was over and we're leaving, Gayan and I are walking up the aisle and he's standing there, you know, picture this, at the top of the aisle, kind of framed in the doorway, seeing me approach and giving me this look of, well, you can't describe. And I put my hand on his shoulder and I said, well done.
Well, I think he was calling that terrifying. Probably until you said well done. So is that what made it memorable, just being there in the Lucas Theater and the premiere and all that?
Well, we'd also been waiting for the film for 3 or 4 years. Yeah. It was in production for a long time.
Well, before we move on to the movies for this year, as I say, the Dazzlers and Duds, I did want to ask, what's one thing that's better about movies now compared to 1974, and one thing that's worse?
Okay, better? Technology. And I don't just mean CGI, like the mind-blowingly awesome rhinoceros in Gladiator 2. That critter looked real. Okay. And of course it wasn't. I mean the whole process. Improved cameras, lenses, and film stock. Editing tools. Today's amazing range of sound effects, and Star Wars was the real game changer in that particular end of things. And the means of getting amazing camera shots these days, particularly with the help of drones. The worst thing? Technology. Hmm. Because too many lazy directors rely on it too much. They'll go for the razzle-dazzle and the special effects. They will cheap out and use CGI for superhero movie stunt work when a lot of it could still be handled by real stunt people doing real stunts. And I don't care how good CGI gets, you can tell the difference. There's a level of verisimilitude that is affiliated with live people doing live stunts. And as a result, too many of today's movies feel, to me, artificial.
So technology you're describing technology displacing the human participation.
Correct.
And the human participation isn't just, okay, you're there doing a stunt, but it's because ultimately this is a story about people, right? Movies are a story
Well, and it's
people.
It's not just that end of it. Think of film scoring. Compare any John Williams score, let's talk particularly about Star Wars again, and the fact that he created specific themes for specific characters throughout that film with a full-blown symphony orchestra, and then compare that to some idiot sitting in a room in front of a keyboard putting together a synth score, which is all you hear.
So in that case, you're losing the orchestra. You're just getting
It's not just that you're losing the orchestra. You're losing the passion. Orchestral music, live music, has passion. It has oomph. It has energy. Too many synth scores, and this gets back to what I said about lazy filmmakers, if you extract them from the movie, it's not a pleasant listening experience. There's, to quote the old famous phrase, there's no there there.
Yeah, I take your point. So the stunt person who's bringing passion, even if it isn't overt on the screen, it still colors, sets the tone for the movie.
Absolutely.
AI is going to be a big factor there too, isn't it?
Because yeah.
The whole idea is can artificial...
Don't even get me started.
I think I know your answer. That's technology multiplied, and so you're saying don't go there.
Actually.
Right. We are talking with Derek Meng. This is the annual movie show. Derek is a film critic here in Davis, California for the Davis Enterprise and his blog, Derek Meng on Film. You're listening to the program Davisville. I'm Bill Buchanan. I'm the host. It's on KDRT 95.7 FM, KDRT.org online. I think we've just identified ourselves.
For better or worse.
For better or for worse. All right. Well, let's get to the big movie season now arriving. What films are you looking forward to and why?
Well, you know, not that many.
You know, the pause there was already starting to tell me, it's like, well, I'll tell you, Bill.
December, this is going to be a longer answer than you expected. You're right. Between Thanksgiving and New Year's Day used to be the big five-week push to the Academy Awards, and studios would save, well, not all, but many of their best stuff. And in a way, it was very frustrating because you couldn't watch them all, you couldn't review them all, and the general public couldn't take them all in. And some very good films would fall by the wayside because there were just too many of them. Well, thanks to all kinds of things, COVID had a great deal to do with it, the recent strikes down in Hollywood, but also changing taste and the fact that even before COVID, people were not going out to the movies as often as they used to. So now you ask me what I'm looking forward to in the next several weeks, I could come up with only three titles.
Ooh, that's got to be a low in all the years we've done.
And that's tragic. But to answer your question, September 5th, I think it's time we had another serious look back at the 1972 Munich Olympics.
So that's the title of the movie, September 5th.
That's the title of the movie, September 5th. Nickel Boys, based on Colson Whitehead's Pulitzer Prize-winning novel about two young black men who get caught in a notorious Florida reform school system in the early 1960s, which I'm sure is going to be an extremely harrowing experience, and a complete unknown. I mean, come on, Bob Dylan in 1965, what's not to look forward to? Timothy Chalamet playing that part. He even looks like Dylan back then.
You know, on Dylan, I'm thinking that movie will resonate differently for people who were alive when Dylan was starting out.
That's true, and I think we're dating ourselves here.
Yeah, well, we are. I mean, I remember him being the cultural phenom, and he still is, but now it's more historic. So those three movies, and it's because of just the people involved and the stories?
Studios aren't releasing as many big guns, and part of the reason I can't give you a longer answer is that I honestly have no idea what might turn up on Amazon Prime, Netflix, Hulu, and Paramount Plus, because they don't do pre-publicity pushes the way the studios did.
That's a good point. I mean, this is part of this ongoing change from the big screen to, well, the big screen at home for a lot of folks, but the whole way the movie arrives.
Absolutely.
Even what a movie is in some respects. I mean, is it four or five parts that you can stream, or is it one real movie? That's interesting. Well, so the strike obviously had a hand in that. I mean, do you think, I'm speculating now, I suppose, do you think it'll be different next year, or do you think we're just headed for more?
Well, let's put it this way. If it isn't different next year, then we really are seeing the slow winding down of what had been a longstanding trend.
The trend of the big end-of-the-year prestigious release?
Well, studio releases, or theatrical releases, yeah. I should say. You know, big movies still turning up in movie theaters. So I think next year is actually going to be an important year to watch in that respect, because if it doesn't bounce back a little bit, you know, we didn't have Barbenheimer this past year.
Mm-hmm. Barbie and Oppenheimer, the two
Barbie
big
and
movies.
Oppenheimer, you know, there weren't two huge films during the summer that kind of got people motivated to go back to the movies again, which made that year, a little bit better than the years before it. So this year, the answer to the question, was this year better, worse, or about the same as last year? I'd say overall it was about the same. It was a decent year for very good films, but not a very good year for great films. And that was also true last year. There were a couple. There have been a couple. But, if you were to ask me who's going to be in the Academy Award categories next year, so far, I still don't know. I can point to some. Yeah.
But is there one that maybe you think was...
People seem to gravitate toward films unexpectedly, and I haven't really seen that happen yet in terms of a must-see title. We Live in Time is making a lot of noise right now. Whether it's going to resonate come Oscar time, I don't know.
You're really describing an ambiguity that is itself is a big change, even from a couple of years ago. It was like, well, will the big screen come back? Or look, here comes streaming. There were these sort of very visible trends. And now it's like it's all tossed. It's all up in the air.
Well, and that's the thing. I don't think anybody knows. I'd hate to be a studio executive right now.
Yeah,
I really would. I wouldn't know which direction to pivot.
Are there any movies coming up that we've had fun some years?
I'm not looking forward to
it. Yeah. Ones that, you think particularly are...
I have three.
Oh, okay. Symmetry.
Sonic the Hedgehog 3. No, thank you.
Now, is that just because you don't like the franchise, or is it just because
I'm not wild about the franchise to begin with. The first one didn't really motivate me. I didn't grow up as a Sonic the Hedgehog kid, so obviously my take is biased in that respect. But a third one, really, seriously, no thank you. It was not a good year for superhero movies. I mean, nobody remembers Madame Web from very early in the year, and boy, that was an awful film. And I don't care how much money Deadpool and Wolverine made, it's still a turkey. And we have one coming up in December called Kraven the Hunter, who is like a bargain basement Marvel Universe villain. And I'm thinking, seriously?
Why is he bargain basement?
Well, he's just not a very popular character, and he's not a very interesting character. He's a hunter. He always gets his prey. I mean, he started out as a Spider-Man villain, if I remember correctly, and I hope I do.
So is that a sign that they're just really at the
bottom
of the barrel?
I'm sorry, they are scraping. But the third one's going to surprise you.
Okay.
The third one I'm not looking forward to is Wicked.
Oh, from the play, the musical.
Ask me why.
Yeah, I why?
Okay, because it's 2 hours and 40 minutes long, and it's only part one.
Oh.
And I'll bet most people don't realize that.
Oh, okay.
The play on Broadway ran 2 hours and 30 minutes, the whole thing.
Yeah, I saw it in San Francisco, and I thought it was
so
wonderful. But
this is something Disney has been very guilty of lately, bloat.
I was going to say, just the numbers kind of condemn it, doesn't it? I mean, it's like if you had a play that was tight and successful and very popular, obviously, and you double the length of it as a movie.
Arbitrarily? Well, we've watched them do this when they did the live-action Beauty and the Beast. It was significantly longer than the animated film. It had at least 2, 3, 4 more songs that did nothing to justify the additional running time. It's not that it wasn't merely different. It wasn't as good.
Okay, so now this is a big movie, so you're probably still going to review it.
Oh, I'm going to have to watch it, absolutely.
And you haven't seen it yet.
And so. I haven't seen it yet, no, as I sit here. It won't open until, I think, late November, if I remember correctly.
Okay.
Right about the time this airs, probably.
And I know you've said in past years, sometimes you change your mind about a movie when you see it.
And I want to repeat what I said earlier. I always walk in waiting and expecting to be amazed. But there are times when the creeping doubt factor is a little stronger.
I think maybe it didn't hit me earlier, but as you said, you always walk in expecting to be amazed.
Yeah.
But you've been doing this for 50 years. Certainly time and gravity have worn down that optimism.
Now, Bill, with very rare exception, I don't think anybody sets out to make a bad movie. It may turn into one along the way.
Well, but don't you think some are indifferent, though? They're just doing the numbers. They're just punching a clock, filling a formula.
Sure. But you never know when something surprising is going to come along.
Yeah, well, that's true.
And that's why I keep doing this, because every year still, we will walk in to see something that doesn't seem like it's going to have a heck of a lot of promise and be amazed and surprised by how delightful and unexpected it turns out to be.
Yeah, so this is some of that optimism you've had from the start, I think.
Yes.
And clearly it has sustained you.
Well, I'm probably not as optimistic as I was in 1974. Who is? But I'd like to think I'm nearly there.
Well, but I'm thinking also of your comment about how one reason you decided as you started to write reviews is you read the reviews in the LA Times and they seemed to be having no fun. They were,
right.
They were, you know, appraising artifacts as opposed to thinking, oh, isn't this cool? We're in this dark. Tell me a story.
You know? Yeah.
And that's the magic, right? You've talked about
it
that
is,
in past
well, it
years.
Is, it is the magic.
And you, being in a room with a bunch of people and there's this story on the screen.
Oh,
you
man.
Enjoy
it
together.
I wish it would be possible to time travel and go back to the days of the really huge movie palaces where you'd be sitting in the midst of 2,000 people watching the same thing at the same time and reacting to it. I mean, the closest I came to that experience was some of the larger theaters in Sacramento in the early 1970s. So, okay, fine. Now we're sitting among 500 to 600 people, which is still a lot of folks. And you don't get that watching it at home.
No, and you can still go. I mean, the Crest is still around and the Tower and places like that.
You know, there's something about knowing that you're experiencing this at the same time as several hundred other people. And that is not part of the movie experience for a lot of today's viewers.
Yeah. It's a little bit like pop music, too. When someone really likes it, then you're sharing it with others. And that's a different experience than simply sort of appreciating music that might move you individually. But there's no one to share it with because everyone goes, who are you talking about?
Right. Well, I mean, that's another rabbit hole.
Yeah, it is another rabbit hole. But okay, so you're going to keep writing reviews, I assume.
Of course I am. It's like breathing. You know, you'll have to, I don't know, well, and see, these. I can't say you'll have to pry the pen from my cold, dead fingers because I don't use a pen.
Yeah, the pen's already been pried.
What's the equivalent? I guess you'll have to yank the cord.
It's cordless now.
No, they're cordless now. I have no metaphor.
Yeah, there's no keyboard even because at some point you'd be able to dictate this to
but
Siri.
But I will be doing this for as long as I can continue to make comprehensive sentences that don't run on quite as long as that one from 1974.
And yeah, that first, I think it was all one dependent clause too. That was something. Well, Derek, thank you for talking with us again today, man. This show was always a great fun to do.
Thank you, Bill. It's always a pleasure to be here.
We're talking with Derek Bang, Davis film critic of 50 years, a point that we've made copiously this half hour. And I'm Bill Buchanan. This is Davisville, KDRT 95.7 FM in Davis, California. Thank you for listening.